VPTC Tech Trends program made possible by support from Inverion of Charlottesville, providing both buyers and sellers of Charlottesville real estate with the strongest possible representation. On the web at www.charlottesville-fine-homes.com.
We are going to have a great conversation this afternoon. And what I want to do is invite our panelists up and introduce them to you. We are very privileged to have with us three local technology experts who are respectively leaders in their field. Janet Driscoll-Miller. Janet, there you are. Janet brings over 7 years of search engine marketing experience to Search Mojo, and she is the, I should have mentioned, the lead search strategist and president and CEO of Search Mojo. Janet was the director of internet marketing at Web Surveyor Corporation, an online survey company. At Web Surveyor, Janet increased the company's Google page rank from 5 to 9, increased the number one rankings on Google by 900%, and decreased pay-per-click advertising spending while doubling the conversion rate. All great metrics, and one of the reasons why we are excited to have Janet with us today. We also have with us Eric Pugh. Eric, come on up. Eric is a principal with Open Source Connections. Fascinated by the craft of software development, Eric has been heavily involved in the open source world as a developer, committer, and user for the past 5 years. He's a member of the Apache Software Foundation and a committer on many projects, including DBUnit, Maven, and Jakarta Commons. In biotech, financial services, and defense IT, he has helped European and American companies develop coherent strategies for embracing open source software. So please welcome Eric. And we also have our third panelist today, Andy Steely from Booz Allen Hamilton. Andy's been a consultant to the defense industry since 1998. He's partnered with consulting industries in Pennsylvania, Maryland, Washington, D.C., and Virginia, and with leaders of cutting-edge web technologies. Andy's been in Charlottesville since 2001. He's currently implementing solutions for the Army's National Ground Intelligence Center with the global consulting firm Booz Allen Hamilton. So please welcome Andy. So we're going to get started, but we're going to get started and have a little bit of serious fun. We're going to talk about some buzzwords, the first of which is Ajax. Now, does anybody want to guess what Ajax is? We're going to play a little stump the band here. Bingo. That was very good, Damon. There's also a possibility that Ajax could be that cool Greek hero in the Brad Pitt movie that was about Troy. We also want to talk about what is a mashup. Anyone want to take a guess at what a mashup is? I'm looking at Michael Pritchard to see if he wants me to call on him. No? Very good. Although that's actually I-95, but that's very good. It's a traffic jam for really cool people. Or it's a web app mixing content from multiple sources. Or it's how those other hotels prepare the lunch that you just ate. Lastly, let's talk about what's a folksonomy. Anybody want to take a guess? Taxonomy developed by people. Okay, well, let's see what we have. Kid slang for folks, it's not me. Or net-based information retrieval methodology, very close. Or, and here's my favorite, a famous folk singer plus a famous economist. Let it play, let it play. Okay, so we've got a lot to talk about today. We're going to have a great and highly interactive conversation. What I want to do is first look at the slide where you see a lot of the buzzwords, a lot of the trend words, a lot of the key concepts that have to do with some of the topics we're talking about today. We're going to touch on some of these, and what we want to do today is give you a very high overview of some of these technologies, and I'll drive it back to how it's going to apply to your business and what you can do on a day-to-day basis to begin to adopt some of these technologies. So first of all, I'm going to start with the panelists and start throwing up some of these words here to talk about what's so 2.0 about this Web 2.0 thing. Now, Eric and Andy and Janet and I were chatting a little bit about some of what makes old applications different than some of the new applications. And I'm going to offer up to you guys to maybe talk us through some of these things and give folks a high-level overview of what's the difference between the old web and the new web.
All right. Can everybody hear me okay? Does this come off?
Yeah.
Okay, so right up there right now, we got a lot of buzzwords up there. And how most people, I think, define Web 2.0 is by a list of symptoms. It's a list of characteristics. We don't really know maybe what the cause of Web 2.0 is, but we know a lot of things about what seem to characterize it. A little bit like, you know, Supreme Court Justice who said, I don't know what I can't define pornography, but I know it when I see it. I don't know what Web 2.0 is, but I know it when I see it, and I've got a couple, you know, up there a list of different things. So, for example, under Web 1.0, we have DoubleClick, a big search, a big advertising engine, and then we have Google AdSense. And for me, maybe what the difference between the two of those is that Google AdSense is trying to tell what exactly are you interested in by the page you're looking at, versus DoubleClick just said, I've got to display 10,000 impressions of the same ad, and you know it doesn't matter whether it's a car site, a food site, or a technology site. I'm going to put up the same advertisement for Ajax Tools or something. Some other ones there, Ofoto versus Flickr. Ofoto is a really powerful photo sharing site. It's one that I really like and we've used in the past. But it doesn't allow a lot of collaboration. It doesn't allow a lot of, I like this picture, or, you know, what are the interesting lists of photos. It's more for, I just put my photos there and me and my friends look at it. Flickr, on the other hand, is all about, you know, I put my photos out there, but I'm broadcasting to a much wider net. I want everybody on the internet to look at it. So I'm tagging my photos. I'm got comments on there. I'm, you know, sharing my photos or saying, you know, you like this picture of Charlottesville? You know, look at the pool of everybody's photos of Charlottesville. So those would sort of be a couple of the ones I see.
I think the thing that you can see that we have in common here on the Web 2.0 side is that these applications are more about people participating, working together. There's often what's called a positive feedback loop. When people contribute to a site, they make it more valuable, which brings in more people, right? So you continually get a more and more valuable website. There. Also, what is that site with Craigslist and Google Maps? Anybody know? Yell it out.
The housing site.
I don't know if it has a name or not, but you would not have seen that in Web 1 because another characteristic is... Another characteristic is these sites are very open for integration. Okay. Napster's a bad example, but sites that are open to integration, that say, hey, you can pull my data and use it in different ways with other applications, they're more likely to be used, more likely to be useful, and more likely to be integrated with to make them more valuable.
Did you want to add anything, Janet?
Yeah, from a marketing perspective, what I see in this list specifically, to touch on what Andy was saying, it's more personal to the end user. It used to be that you had DoubleClick, which just forced ads, regardless of who you are, to you. And now you have Google AdSense, which is something that looks at what kind of content you're actually looking at and gives you things that are more targeted towards you. Same with search engine optimization. It's huge today. Why do companies need to be number one on the web? It used to just be that domains were important, and even finding a domain anymore is challenging that's appropriate for your company. But why is search engine optimization important? Well, because it's more targeted. It's targeted towards you and what you're looking for. And that's one of the things that I think defines Web 2.0 is now it's not just pushing out to the masses in a marketing perspective, it's also much more targeted to your needs and your individual uses as an individual.
We're actually going to take a look. We have some screenshots of some of the other sites that we had mentioned here, including Zillow, which was the real estate site that Andy was talking about. But these are this is just kind of a recap, I think, of what some of the key and core competencies are for Web 2.0. This material comes from Tim O'Reilly, who had really articulated early on what a lot of the attributes of Web 2.0 are. Anything you guys want to comment on with regard to this?
Love to talk about the long tail. Here's what the long tail is. It's important that you know it, okay? If you don't know what the long tail, how many people have heard of the long tail and know what it is? Okay, well, you guys just bear with me. The long tail, okay. Imagine that I am a, imagine that I'm Barnes & Noble and I get this big spike in my sales around the most popular books, or I'm a music provider and I've got a, when I watch my demand curve, I get this area where I get the most sales, okay? Store retailers, physical retailers like Walmart or like Barnes & Noble stores or whatever, can only put so many books out there, right? So they focus their sales in that main curve. Everybody follow me? What they're missing are the ends of that curve. They're missing the long tail where the very specialized and very small margin products add up and become a larger volume of sales. So Barnes & Noble can't put so many specialized books about rock climbing with, you know, in Indonesia with, I don't know, whatever, something very specific. But Amazon can do that because they don't have to go out to the shelves. They don't have to publish these books. They can give you that selection. They can cater to your needs. They can cater to the needs of more people because they have this web distribution system. You know, I have an infinite number of books on my shelves, so I can satisfy a lot more people. And that actually turns out that it adds up to a lot more sales. I think half of Amazon.com book sales, I read somewhere, add up to the same amount of sales as their most popular items. So the long tail is actually quite a significant amount of business for them.
And maybe somewhat related to the long tail, it's not just business that it applies to as well. It applies to, you know, one of your bullet points is there is trusting users as co-developers. Wikipedia has been incredible. How many people are familiar with Wikipedia? Okay, right. It's the encyclopedia of the web. And if someone said, okay, I want to create a new encyclopedia, and I'm going to create it from scratch. If you had to develop it with individual paid resources or individual people, you'd never get the job done. But, you know, Wikipedia has been able to leverage everybody out there, and even someone who maybe just contributes one little article out there about rock climbing in Indonesia, you know, they're going to get hits because, you know, you can put that kind of content into something where the storage space is unlimited. It's not a paper Encyclopedia Britannica, you know, volume 82. It's Wikipedia, and so anyone can contribute to that. So you get all those little tidbits that maybe wouldn't fit in a more physical world.
So let's take a look at some of these more detailed oriented items. The next couple slides in here are actually more technical. One of them actually gives you kind of a metastructure of what Ajax is all about. We're going to kind of gloss over this one. We can kind of geek out and talk about this more on the side, but there is some substance to this stuff. So, how many of you dig? Anybody here dig? One, two hands, three, okay. You want to talk about Dig?
So,
Eric?
Dig is a site. I don't know if other people, Slashdot are famous. Slashdot was a site where editors would go out and collect content. And a lot of blog aggregators are like that. You've got a couple editors and they go out and collect content. Dig is a little bit different, that anyone can submit content, and people who are reading the comment can say, oh, I really like this article, and they click dig, I dig it. And that raises the value of that content compared to all the other content that's in the system. So it's a very user-generated what is interesting to people right now. Now, Dig does have its own personality, right? It's a lot of tech stuff. It's a lot of open source stuff. But it's the content is it, the value of the content, which articles get read the most, is based on people being really interested in it and saying, I dig it. And so what's happened is other services, like if I write a great blog article about something, I might put at the bottom, here's my little dig button, and Dig has set it up very nicely so that I can put a little dig icon on my blog, and if you really like my blog, you'll click the dig button, and that'll help the rating of my article go up a little bit amongst compared to all the other dig articles.
Again, you want to notice that positive feedback loop here. The more people that dig and contribute, the more likely it is that when you go to dig, relevant articles are at the top because everybody else said they were relevant to them too. And so you're more likely to go back and you're more likely to participate, yada, yada. By the way, the guy that you saw up there was a guy named Kevin Rose. He's the guy that started Dig. And they have a very, I guess it's a weekly podcast or something called Dig Nation. It's pretty funny, pretty cool to watch.
We talked about Zillow. Let's talk about Zillow for a little bit. Eric, Andy, Janet.
Well, one of the things that makes Zillow interesting is it's a great example of a mashup 2.0 style. For example, if you look at that site, you see at the top that advertisement for a mortgage, right? What a great wow, that's a great deal. That advertisement is being pushed to them probably by some ad company. So they're not hosting. They didn't write all the code required to put advertising up on their site. They just leveraged someone else. The picture in the middle, all that data came from a mapping company, but the actual map itself is not Google Maps, but one of the big map providers.
It's Microsoft.
Okay, it's Microsoft's mapping engine. And then what they've done is they've done the value add of figuring out how do we index the location of all these houses by address and merge in the price of all those houses. And so that looks like a street that's not too far from where I live. And it's really interesting that all of a sudden I can look at my neighborhood and see what is the market value of all the houses in my neighborhood.
And here's a little blow-up of what that shot is. And what's really interesting about how they're positioning this is they've got a 3D bird's eye view of the block or of the properties with some tags as to real estate values. So there's been a lot of discussion in the mainstream conversation about not only the disruptive value of an application like Zillow, but also the company and commercial value of an organization like Zillow. Is it going to sustain itself? What's going to happen with its disruptive effect on how conventional real estate industry works? So we'd certainly be interested to hear how applications like this are going to mesh with your businesses or have an impact on your businesses. Let's also talk a little bit about LinkedIn. I know three of you wanted to mention something about
that. Okay, well, this was my suggestion of what looks like a very Web 2.0 application, and in my opinion, really isn't a Web 2.0 application. So how many people here are LinkedIn, use LinkedIn? All right, I expect to see invites from all of you, in my email box, because personally, I feel like LinkedIn is basically a popularity contest. Who can get the most links? And I noticed, like, this guy's focused in sales and marketing. Man, they have so many business contacts. And, you know, maybe us more tech people, maybe we're a little shyer and we don't get quite as many invitations. So I'd appreciate it if y'all connected to me. But, you know, LinkedIn, in terms of a really valuable tool, well, it's very, very much a closed garden, and it's very walled off. I can only do with the LinkedIn tool set and the LinkedIn product what they want me to do. I want to contact someone who is a friend, you know, a contact of a contact. I have to go through their tool and use their special, okay, you've used one of your free invitations to someone else. I want to dig down and maybe look at some specific data or slice and dice it in a specific way. They provide some tools, but I've really got to use their tools. I can't particularly say, give me a map of where all my contacts or my one degree removed contacts are in the world. I can't pull out all those addresses and lay them over a Google Earth or a Google map. And so LinkedIn looks very 2.0 because it's very collaborative and we all meet each other through it and, you know, stuff. But it's a very strict and closed off service. And I posit that it doesn't have as much value as it would if they loosened up on the reins a little bit and let people do a little bit more, gave a little more visibility into whose contacts are whose contacts, instead of trying to monetize in every little action that you do inside LinkedIn.
That's very true. I actually am a LinkedIn person, and I'm one of those geeks that has about 100 contacts right now. So I invite everybody I know to it. But the challenge with a product like this, just like what Eric was saying, it is they do try and monetize it. And so it's less collaborative from the get-go just because of the monetization of the way that they try and market this particular tool. I actually have a business membership. I pay $15 a month for it, and that allows me to contact anyone in any network, whether I'm linked to them through a third party or not. However, there's all this permission-based coding in there as well, where people have to accept, people have to say, yes, I want to be your contact. It is a lot less collaborative than, say, other types of tools that allow you to actually have discussions, like a blog might or something. You can't, or a news group or a forum. You really don't have that opportunity with LinkedIn, unfortunately, because they've tried to monetize each piece of it.
And I want to talk a little bit about web services too. We'll just touch on it lightly. I don't want to get technical, I promise. But who knows what a web service is? That's a pretty good crowd. Does anybody want to tell me why it's good? Why they like web services? Why that's thumbs up?
You can talk cross-platforms, you can share data, even if you're running on Microsoft and somebody else is open source running Apache on Linux, stuff like that. It's crossing that technical divide that was always there.
Absolutely. It's a way of, regardless of platform, sharing data between systems. I don't know if Google Maps or Google Earth or whatever uses a web service, but they use a type of a web service for that mashup that they do. Web service is a standard way of systems sharing data. And if you don't have a web service with your data, no one else can use it. No one else can integrate it and make a better product with it. And so you may lose a little value there. And you may get a lot of value if you make your data available through this web service thing to other people. So I had to mention web services. Thank you.
I have a quick question. I hope it's not too far afield. It's a two-parter. I get the value of allowing your users to be co-developers and the fact that we're all putting our minds together and the value of that with this Web 2.0 idea. But my question is, how are we ensuring that that information is true and correct? Who's checking the veracity of all that information, one? And secondly, do you think Web 2.0 will create a need for trusted advisors to emerge to say, what's on our site is more true than what's on that other site? I mean, who's gonna help us figure out what's real?
What a great point.
That's a very good point, actually. For instance, if you went on Wikipedia a couple weeks ago and looked up rabbits, you'd learn to your surprise that rabbits are carnivorous. And I don't remember who the comedian on, you know, late night TV was that did it, but he went and just changed it right there. And so, you know, for a period of time, rabbits, according to Wikipedia, were carnivorous. And I'm sure Google was indexing that. And, you know, if you looked it up, there was that potential. So you have a very good point. And so one of the concept of how good is this data, really, eventually we're going to have great reputation engines that say what is, you know, this content has been validated according to a reputation engine that says, okay, anything written by this comedian, you might want to look at it really suspectly because a lot of people dispute it. Wikipedia has a very strict policy or has a lot of tools in place to deal with how good is this content, right? Anyone can dispute an article and say, well, I dispute that, and your name goes right there. And if you see an article with 10 disputes below it, you probably don't want to use that as your primary source or, you know, your first source of information. So there is that, and there is also the potential as you let more people into your system, there's going to be egg on your face at some point. Something weird is going to happen. And so until we get great editorial staff or reputation engines or something that kind of helps you validate, you know, this content, that is an issue. There's a lot of blogs out there. that are technical tutorials that say the wrong thing because they were written 5 years ago when blogging first came on the picture. And in 5 years, content has changed or ideas have changed, techniques have changed, but no one's gone back and said, well, this blog is old. So we as consumers are also going to have to be smarter and be a little more skeptical. If a blog was written 5 years ago, you might want to look at it a little carefully. You go to the people that you trust, and so that's going to be a big issue as all this content is out there, is how much of it can you trust?
I will speak as the devil's advocate here and the person who has some doubts about Web 2.0. speaking from a marketing perspective, it is a huge problem. This collaboration issue is a huge problem. It has actually affected me. It's affected my clients. And from a public relations perspective, it can be very negative because, as Eric was mentioning, we don't necessarily have all of the sites yet formed that say this site is an authoritative site, this site is not. This person is authoritative, this person is not. The other challenge is I have, as an example, a mattress retailer as a client. And on the search engines, one of the reviews that someone gave for one of their mattresses came up from the ePinions website. And I don't know that anyone really uses ePinions anymore, but it was something from like 4 years ago, just like Eric mentioned. We can't take it down. We can't contact this person. We can't say, we're really sorry. We want to give you a free bed. There's nothing we can do. So from a PR perspective, it's definitely a real challenge for companies because anyone can say whatever they want to say. And it doesn't have the same rules that apply to writing something bad about someone in the press, which is untrue. And it's even happened to me. I've had people say things about me online that are untrue. And I've had to try and fight legal battles over it. It's something that is still not solved, and it's something you have to be on top of from a marketing PR perspective because there is no control in place at this point. And just like Eric was mentioning, someone can go up to Wikipedia and put false information. So it's not something you can 100% trust, and you have to be careful from your own marketing PR perspective and monitor that type of information so you can combat it as best you can in your own way.
And if I'm recalling correctly, and you guys can correct me if I'm off base here, there's a European initiative with Wikipedia where they're introducing a trusted advisor sort of editorial filter, where as opposed to posts to Wikipedia and edits to Wikipedia being published immediately, they're going to experiment with them being filtered through a known and trusted editor, and they're very new in that initiative, but it's been response to some of these issues that you folks have been talking about. I want to go on to a couple of things that have been in the mainstream press and give our panelists an opportunity to talk about them and to comment on them. This is from Bruce Sterling, noted science fiction author, talking about some of these Web 2.0 companies. What he's basically positing is that they have a tremendous amount of leverage and momentum because of how they are taking advantage of the participation economy. So Eric or Andy, do you see this as a key attribute for growing companies in the Web 2.0 space?
You know, I don't. As a geek, how many people have heard, there are a bunch of other geeks out there, how many of you have heard of 37 Signals? Right, a bunch of you. For every 37 Signals is a consulting firm that developed a web development platform called Ruby on Rails, and they do a lot of conferences, they do a lot of blogging, and they don't do any advertising, and they're raking money in. However, for every one of those that kind of came up with a unique idea, there's a lot of other companies that, you know, are not that particular company. You would argue that all these things that they're doing are their ad campaign. Developing a web development platform is an incredible advertisement for the company behind it. Being speakers at conferences is an incredible advertisement behind it. So I think that a lot of the ideas that we don't need advertising is a little bit false. Web 2.0 doesn't mean that the old success factors for a company can all be thrown out. You don't need a business model anymore. You don't need structure. You don't need advertising, marketing, sales, support, all of that. The architecture of participation, I do think that where it helps is things, I keep harping on Wikipedia, but Wikipedia managed to be the first successful online encyclopedia, and they don't have to do advertising because of their scope and their breadth and their integration with everything else. But you know, directly connecting people, there's a lot of great services out there that directly connect people that no one has heard of. For example, who's here heard of Lala.com? Okay, one person, which is very impressive. Lala.com is a site where you sign up and you say, I've got this list of CDs that I'm not interested in anymore, and these are the CDs I want, and they handle, you pay $1.75 for shipping and their transaction cost, and you can, you know, you mail your CDs out and they mail new CDs to you. So it's a sharing service. That's a company that could do very, very well, but without any marketing, any advertising, they're going to go nowhere because they've got a great product. But if it never enters sort of the mass, you know, the mass consciousness, they're going to stay a niche product. So, you know, they'll be advertising. It just, if they might be advertising on Napster, on, you know, file sharing services or music magazines.
And I also think the thing that Sterling is talking about here is, for example, MySpace, right? MySpace. You find out about MySpace because somebody sends you this weird email and says you should join up on MySpace or Flickr or the same thing, right? They send out, so the users that are using it are the ones that get the word out just because they want you to play with them. And I think that's a phenomenon and it's out there. I don't think it's necessarily Web 2.0 based, but it definitely works in those models anyway, you know. The users take care of inviting other people in and telling them. But that's not the case for things like, you know, Lala or Dig or something like that.
Let's talk about privacy for a minute. That was one of the themes of the question that was asked earlier. How many recall the incident that was in the news a week or two ago about the AOL release of search results? Handful of you. You guys want to talk to that?
I have not read this article, so I'll let someone else talk.
I will say it's probably the scariest thing about the web, and I don't think it's Web 2.0. It's something that started when we started living our lives online, is that privacy, you know, you really have no privacy, and anyone who thinks that they do should not, you know, you need to not use the Internet. You just saw Zillow. You can find out how much my house is worth. Google for my name, and you know, that, I tell people, that's my resume. Google for my name. You'll find both the good and the bad. You'll find the projects where I did something silly and people were like, why did you do that? As well as where people said, oh, that's great. Thank you so much for helping me out. So your, you know, search and all the content that we're putting online, it really is an issue. That privacy, as we consider it, and being an anonymous person, it's almost impossible on the Internet. You know, everybody I'm sure who's gotten a lot of spam probably has two email addresses. This is the email address I use when I really want to get something, and here's the one that I use when I don't want to get something. But all that information out there, privacy, how you're going to maintain it, how you're going to control it, it's a very difficult thing, and it flies against a lot of what we consider the collaborative nature of Web 2.0. And people need to be careful about what they do because their personal lives and their public lives can very easily converge. You know, someone I know, he's got a business that he runs, but he is also an aspiring politician. And those two worlds on the Internet will cross because he's got the same name. So, you know, the amount of control and power that companies like Google or AOL or Amazon have over who we are and what we're interested in is astonishing. And you know, you can look at it as a very frightening thing, but you can also look at it as an opportunity for corporations to be good citizens and how much more important it is now to be a good citizen and to have that very positive record about your company, we maintain security and everything, than maybe 10 or 20 years ago.
I'll also add that privacy issues are nothing new on the Internet. So this is, to me, not shocking, actually, that AOL lost this data. And the reason I'm not shocked by it is because they've been tracking this information on me, and Just like a laptop gets stolen from the Veterans Administration, this information can get out there. And so, and like I said, privacy is not a new issue on the internet. It's been an issue for a long time. And just like Eric said, it's something that if you're on the internet, you have to know that you're able to be tracked. There's many ways that you're able to be tracked on the internet that you as a user just don't even realize are there. And so you have to be careful. It's not just at work. They can definitely track everything you do at the office. But anywhere you are, if you're an AOL member, if you use Google, any of those things can be tracked. So you have to think about that. And if you're not doing anything nefarious, does it matter that everyone knows where you went on the internet? Maybe not. And in fact, in some cases, by having these tracking mechanisms to know where you're going, you're actually served better on the internet because you're getting things targeted towards you that are more likely things that you would like instead of things you don't like. So I think that there's some positives and negatives to the tracking of information. The biggest negative, of course, being the information getting out. But if you have nothing to hide and you're not doing anything wrong, who cares that you went and surfed Google? No one cares. So the people who really should be concerned are people who are probably doing things they shouldn't be. I wouldn't let it get to me too much, and really don't be afraid to be on the internet and search these different areas or do these different things unless maybe you're doing something you don't want people to find out about, and maybe then you shouldn't be doing it.
Two stories. The first one is something that was dug up on Dig. Google is considering, one of their lead tech guys said, "Well, we were thinking about the system where we turn on, while the computer's running, we listen on the computer's microphone to what your, I'm not joking, to what your TV is playing or what your music is playing, and we decode it, and then we suggest products based on that. So it's more or less like a listening device in your living room while your computer is on. That's good times. But listen, also, a buddy of mine briefed a proposal on this system that tracks cars to help with traffic. And in like 2010, every car is going to have a chip in it, and so we'll be able to predict, you know, where the traffic backups are. And you know, unfortunately, I hate that. I mean, I hate that personally, but I think that people are just going to accept it, and they're going to accept that they're going to be tracked and accept that their privacy is out the window, and things are going to continue to move in that direction just because, I mean, you know, we don't mind that our telephone calls are monitored either, but, I mean, just to be controversial here, but I think that trend is going to continue, and we're going to slowly lose privacy. But
I don't know if any of you ever go to Northern Virginia and go through the Dulles Toll Road to get to the airport or what have you, but I used to live up there, and they have these things called smart tags that are toll road payment systems. And I actually had people tell me, "I don't want one because I don't want the government to know where I'm going." And I was like, it makes my life easier. I don't care if they know I went to Reston today or I went to Herndon. Who cares? I just want it to be easier. So I think it's a lot of, too, your personal take on it. For me, I have a busy life. I want it to be easier. I have nothing to hide that I'm going to Herndon or Reston or wherever. So I enjoy those types of technologies, whereas other people might feel like it is an invasion of their privacy. I don't want you to really know everything about me. I don't want the chip in my car so you can track where I'm going. Whereas my response to that would have actually been, yay, I can avoid I-66 traffic today because it's going to tell me where I can get around it. So I think it's two different personalities, too, and what you feel comfortable with from a privacy perspective. I think the bigger issue is what nefarious things can people do with that information? And I guess I'm trusting to hope that they're not going to do anything bad with it, but there are a lot of people out there who will question and say, what are you going to do with my information and how are you going to use it against me?
Which kind of brings up one last thing. It's very easy to fearmonger about privacy. And one of the things, though, that I do think that Web 2.0, one of the ideas is that your data really should be your information. And so one of the things that you hope you're going to see out of these Web 2.0 companies is the ability to erase your tracks, to take your data with you. For example, you know, I think it would be a perfectly reasonable request to be able to have a button on Google that says, I erase all my data, all my personal data about me on Google, and I have to put up with the fact that I get weird ads and my search results aren't tailored to me, etc. Sort of related to that, there was a Web 2.0 company called Kiko. They did an online calendar, and they came out, unfortunately, around the time that Google's calendar came out, and they went out of business. One of the things I thought they did amazingly well, they did two things. They sold their company for like $800,000 on eBay, which was just astonishing. But the other thing they did is they said, we're going out of business, and they added a button onto their website that did two things. One, it cleared out all your personal data out of their web-based calendar. And the other thing was it allowed you to take that data and download it onto your computer in a format that you could import it into your Outlook calendar or Safari or Apple iCal. And so they sort of acknowledged the privacy issues of being a web-based company, and they said you can, you know, cover your tracks and you can get your data back out. And there's other organizations. There's an effort called OpenID, and they want to basically set up a system where all the data that you give to all these various companies gets stored on their server or another OpenID registered server. And so you can pick who do I want to trust with all my personal information, and then all the different companies that pull that information from that OpenID source, you know, have to validate. And you know, if you decide that Amazon no longer gets my shopping records or something, then you can block access to that. So I think that we're going to evolve, and that privacy, you know, in some ways we may feel like we're losing a lot of privacy, but we also may gain a lot of control over where our information goes, you know, and have that sense of we're sharing our information to those who we want to have it, and we're able to block it from those we don't.
I think we have a question on the floor here.
To the remarks that you've just been making about privacy and how that is going to fit in with a thought I was having at the same time, which is one of the things that has never lived up to my expectations in terms of practical application has been CRM tools. What I constantly see happening in the retail environment is if it's the first time that you've ever had a belt card, guess what, you get 10% off. Or, you know, if this is your first GM card, we'll give you 0% financing. And in my, I've spent a life in sales and marketing, and the message that's been clear to me through that whole career is the lifetime value of a customer analysis. And do I, in fact, want to take a customer who I'm past my acquisition cost with? You know, and there's repeat business there, and I appreciate how valuable that is. Can some of these Web 2.0 tools that you're talking about into what you're saying about shopping records and things like that, do you envisage a role at some point where these records can be intermingled with maybe a digital ID that is not necessarily your social, but it allows the whole concept of mass customization for retailers or wholesalers or whatever to say, you know, this is a valuable customer. They have a propensity to do these things. Maybe they like cutting edge, so I'll push out the cutting edge thing to them. But I'm not gonna sort of cheapen the experience by saying you have to pay more than people who've never done business with me before. And I just wonder if you see any of that sort of coming on the horizon.
I think that that's one of the advantages that having your data online, but having some control over it, is that if you're a valuable customer with one particular type of company, another company may feel that there's a real value in giving you a special discount because they're in a complementary product line, and right now they don't have a really good way of getting that data. And so if we had better ways of sort of managing our data and being able to say who we are, then it offers new features and potentially new discounts, and it's, you know, things that make our lives better by sharing and selectively sharing that information. And you think about it, how much information does MasterCard and Visa own about you, right? We've all sort of made the decision that the credit card company is someone we can trust with our personal information. And yes, I know they just pass the information through to the banks and, you know, member banks, et cetera, but we've made that decision that they're worth trusting. And so if MasterCard had a program set up where they said, you know, we know that you like these sorts of things, and here are some recommendations, and by the way, these companies, because they know a little bit about you, are willing to give you a special deal, a hotline, a special number, and they're doing it only because they know how valuable, they know already a certain amount about you, I think that there's real value in there.
I'm sorry, Andy. I want to take two questions from the floor, and then we'll go back to your point, Andy.
I'm actually curious about, in terms of Web 2.0, we haven't really talked about the web becoming a platform. In other words, like Salesforce.com, which actually opens up their application for others to integrate with it. So, for example, it's a CRM at its core, but yet use it as CRM, but then write your own software to integrate it with, say, your inventory system, for example. I'd be curious to hear your thoughts about software companies going that route in terms of opening up their applications on the web via a web service API to integrate with other software.
So I'm not familiar with Salesforce. Is that an open source thing, or is that
it's a mixture of open source, but then they have
It's a mixture of open source, but yet they have a paid type of service. It's huge. I mean, it's got 140,000 users or something like that right now.
Well, yeah, I know that we were discussing Google Apps too, and I don't want to jump ahead if you're going to talk about that later. But things like Google Spreadsheets and Google and Writely, if anyone's ever used anything like that, are more of a service-based application model. Using the web, is that sort of what you're talking about? Things like that, using the web as a platform?
Yeah.
Yeah, and Ajax and things like that make that possible. I see a couple holes there. If my boss wants to work on a proposal, or he wants to do a financial spreadsheet, he wants to be able to do it on a plane, and he can't do that if he's not connected to, you know, the server. And he also doesn't want his data to be anywhere but on his machine. I think those are a couple problems that we're going to have to deal with for the web as a platform and for service-based architectures. There, maybe you have some sort of offline storage backup thing or whatever. But I want to get to this other point, and it was, but I forget what it is now. So never mind.
All right, let me take Gary's question here.
You all have talked about various ways in which people can put some information about themselves out there in order for other companies to push something appropriate down to them. Can you talk for a minute about the opposite, where somebody more or less puts out, this is what I'm interested in, and it's a pull situation coming the other direction in light of 2.0?
So by pull, you mean that they're saying that they're able to pull content in, or that companies are able to find a set of customers on the web and then be able to market to them?
The latter, where, you know, I'm interested in a big stainless grill, you know, with these kind of sort of things. All right, I want the web to now respond to my interest. And rather than being deluged with all kinds of ads of what people mm-hmm. think you want, you get to say, this is what I really want, but I'm not searching for it. I'm asking for you to find my information request.
I'm not aware of anything right now that uses that kind of technology other than search engines. I found them. That's why I think they've gained such popularity. And they're taking their model and moving it to other things, such as Google taking that to its shopping engine, Frugal, so that they can remember things like that. So I'm not certain that there's anything across many websites, and maybe you all know of something, that can remember, or you can say, I'm interested in, you know, in shoes, or I'm interested in the Redskins, or whatever it might be, and that it provides you with shopping options like that. The only other thing I know of is the Google AdSense. So if I was reading an article about the Redskins and I love them, then what's going to happen is, as I'm reading the article, you might see Google ads at the side that are relative to that. So in that way, you are getting served things that might be appropriate to you. But I don't know if you have any comments, Eric.
All right. Actually, this actually ties directly back to my problem with LinkedIn, which is one of the things I would like to use LinkedIn is, all the people on my LinkedIn network are people that I've met somehow, have some personal relationship with them. And one of the things I would love to do with my LinkedIn note is to be able to say, hey, I need a plumber, right? Or I want to get a grill. And I want to be able to publish that little bit of information out there, but I'm not looking to sign up on the grill mailing list or your, you know, go really, really deep. And so there is an opportunity, and there's a problem right there, that you can't publish just a little bit of information about yourself on a sort of a centralized network of some variety and be able to pull it in. The Neon Guild mailing list, Neon Guild, probably quite a few people hear from that, you know, a bunch of web designers and stuff, but it's funny to see the, you know, I need this and name whatever service it is. And people are putting those out there because it's a trusted sort of source of advice, and it's a small network that you've already vetted. And if we could do that without maybe having to push our request on everybody, but still be able to sort of easily update it, I think that there's a real potential there. MySpace, one of MySpace's interesting things about it was people could put up their current status, single, married, dating, just friends, right? They could put that up there, and then they could change that, and they would just, you know, whatever. And among people who use MySpace, it's an issue when you go from just friends to dating, or just dating to boyfriend, girlfriend. And you're putting out that little bit of information, and, you know, that's information people can consume, your friends, your, you know, all that. They actually had an issue with that recently. They turned it on, I want to say last week, where they started aggregating all those little bits of information and blasting it out in sort of a very condensed feed to lots and lots of people. And that wasn't what people wanted out of it. They weren't trying to advertise themselves. They weren't trying to say, you know, I just went from, just dating to boyfriend-girlfriend. I didn't want to blast that out to everybody. I was just flipping that little bit of information to people who might be interested in me. So when you're looking for a grill, you might not, if you say, I'm looking for a grill, you're not looking to send out a mass email or a condensed information to 10,000 different providers, plus all your business contacts and everything else. You're just hanging that little bit out, and if someone comes across your site and says, you know, oh, I, you know, just bought a great grill from Ron Martin, or, you know, from Martin Hardware, they got the entire grill section downstairs, then I would let you know that. So that particular model, they have that in sort of a friends situation on MySpace, and it's one of the strengths of MySpace, that hasn't really broadened out to a lot of different areas, and it definitely does not cross multiple websites. So there's your new startup.
So we're going to talk about some search engine optimization topics, and then I still want to allow some time for some questions from the folks in the audience. Janet, do you want to just walk us through at a high level? I know we've got a couple of slides here, but just walk us through at a high level what we need to be paying attention to.
I'm probably going to go through these a little quickly, so if anybody has any questions, feel free to ask or meet up with me afterwards. I just want to describe what search engine marketing is. It's generally composed of two parts. One is the paid ads, which is PPC, or pay-per-click advertising. You typically pay for your advertising that way every time someone clicks on your ad, not by what they call impression, which is every time someone would see your ad. That's the old method. The impression method is the old method of advertising. And then there's search engine optimization, which is actually getting your site higher in the rankings on Google, Yahoo, MSN, all the search engines. Actually, what we'll show on the next slide is where that is actually on the results. One more slide. So this is an example of Google results. So as an example, I searched the word presentations. You can see the top yellow areas. I've highlighted them. They're not normally yellow on Google. And the side on the right-hand side are where the ads appear. They're typically called sponsored results. And the blue is the natural web results. This is where Google goes out, has a search engine, what we call a robot, goes out, or a spider, goes out to your website, searches it, and comes back with a list of rankings and results for that word, presentations. That it thinks these sites, these pages are relevant to that particular word. And then this is the same situation on Yahoo, so you see the very similar layout as well. Why is search engine optimization important? I think a lot of you probably know that it's important just because that's the way your businesses get found. But and this just shows the growth of people looking for specific things on the Internet. The search has increased by 28% last year over the previous year, so it's growing exponentially every year. Google is currently the top, and actually I forgot to update this slide. Currently, as of today, Google has about 60% of all search engine traffic. So it is the behemoth of the search engine market. And the interesting thing about, as we talked about the long tail, one of the things that the long tail does mention is the fact that that more and more people are going towards longer-term searches. You don't see people searching on the word shoes anymore. People don't do that because what are you going to get back if you search for shoes? You're going to get all kinds of things that are irrelevant to your search. You might get horseshoes, you might get dancing shoes, and maybe you're really looking for running shoes. So more and more people are actually searching using 2- and 3-word searches or even longer searches to get the most relevant results to what they're looking for. Now, this is really important. 87%, and I bet all of you in this room are probably like this too, 87% of people do not go past the first page of search results. So it's important for companies to be on the first page for that reason. 33% of searchers believe the top ranking is also the top brand in the industry. So it's really important to be top because when you search and you typically probably click on the first result, you're probably thinking that's probably a very trusted source for that particular item that you're looking for. And of course, obviously, if you see an increase in search engine ranking, you probably see an increase in your website traffic as well. And then most people who do do search engine research are looking for things to buy. There's a very large number of people who are doing that, researching items on the internet. Even if you have an offline business, a brick and mortar business, people are doing their research online and then actually going to a store. So that's just to show you some average budget for the year as well, what people typically spend on search engine optimization. Now, this is what I was talking about with people clicking and on the first page. This is called a heat map, and you all have probably seen these in different types of examples before. But on the left is Yahoo, on the right is Google, and these are, I believe, these were used car searches, but I don't remember. A company out in California called iTools did a study where they put some people in a room, had them do some searches on Google and Yahoo, and then they tracked where those people's eyes were going on a page. And what they did was they overlaid a heat map on top of that so they could see where's the place that the people look the most and click the most versus where they look and click the least. And, of course, the red area is where they look and click the most. So as you can see, at the top of a page, that's where they obviously look and click the most, whereas the dark blue, the very dark bluish black color, is where they do not click or look as much. So, again, really important for people to be at the top because that's where people actually click and search. Just found a study, and actually this is somewhat based on the AOL data that was released, so it was kind of a good thing for me because I got a little more insight into the way people search. And so that I can help my customers predict better where they should be. This shows if you're a certain position, position 1 being the highest position on a page, position 10 being the lowest, the percentage of people who click on each position. So as you can see, almost half the people click on the first position, so who are looking at that page. So the majority of clicks obviously go to the top position, really important, whereas only 3% go down all the way to the bottom of the page.
Okay, so one of the things that I had asked Janet and Andy and Eric to think about is, you know, what are the big kind of three takeaways when you leave the room? What do they really want to drive home about these new technology trends in terms of how you're going to integrate them and make them a part of your businesses and business strategies? So I'll give each of you an opportunity to kind of talk to your takeaway points. Janet, I think you're first.
First I'd just say that there's a lot of people have questions about search engine optimization. How do I get started? What do I do? These are basically the three things that are the most important. It doesn't matter what search engine you're on. Doesn't matter who you're trying to optimize for. These are the three things that are key to everything. The first one is your keywords that you want to be found on. So when someone puts in a word in Google or Yahoo or MSN that you think describes your company and you think you should be ranked number one for, what is that word? So you want to think about that. And as I mentioned, you don't want to have words like shoes. You want to have something more specific like dancing shoes or running shoes, whatever really describes your company, and even possibly more specific than running shoes. You might have Nike running shoes. So the more specific you can be, the better off you are. I have a lot of folks who come to me who make the initial mistake of going too broad, like shoes, and that's too broad. You really want to look at keywords that are very specific to you. Content. Because these search engines have these robots or spiders that go out and look at your website and decide what your website's about, it won't know that your website's about a particular topic if you never mention that keyword. So it's really important to put that keyword in your pages. And then the biggest thing is link popularity. This actually goes back to the Web 2.0 abuse issue that we talked about earlier. It's kind of funny. When all of you leave, if you go back to your desk and type in the word waffles into Google, you'll find, and I'm not trying to be partisan here because I will be bipartisan, you'll find that John Kerry's website comes up in the top 10 results in Google. And the question is, how does that happen? It seems so ridiculous. He doesn't have the word waffles on his website, right? And he, I believe last time I checked, outranked the Waffle House. So you kind of ask yourself, why does that happen? And to be bipartisan, if you do the same thing for worst president ever, George Bush's bio on the White House website comes up. So how does that happen? Well, it happens because of these people going out and building third-party links to John Kerry's website and to George Bush's bio on the White House website with those words and the links that they're using. And so yet again, when we talk about PR and marketing, and we talk about abuse of your brand on the web, that's a huge problem because really, this happens mostly, I think, with political parties, but I'll see emails from my friends going, hey, check this out, it's pretty funny, you know, search for waffles on Google and see what comes up. What is happening is the other party will hire people, I assume, and they will build these links to make these jokes happen. And so there is potential even for abuse in search engines, and it's something that you have to watch out for with your brand as well. Those are my big three takeaways from search engine optimization, and so I'll hand it over to you guys.
Okay, Andy, here are your three thoughts.
A couple things here. I don't know if anyone came into this event with the idea that Web 2.0 is something that you plug into your website and then it's great. That's not. If you had that idea, that's not how it works. Web 2.0 is sort of an observation about what makes websites successful. So don't have that misconception. Play with others nicely. Make sure that your data can be used in other ways because that increases its value, increases what people can do with it. Power the people. Give power to your users so that they can create that positive feedback loop. They can make your site better for you, whether it's things like Folksonomies where they tag up your data for you or make your data more relevant to others. Let them do that and keep a close eye on them. I just want to take a couple. Who's Google here? Who's a Google user versus, wow. Who's a Yahoo user? Wow. Okay. Interesting. Just had to know that. I remember my point, and that is, so if you guys are going to be storing data, like, give your users the option to opt out. Give your users the option to delete what you're storing about them. For, you know, paranoid guys like me who are doing nefarious things.
And Eric, your final thoughts here?
So mine are somewhat in line with Andy's and Dan's as well, but, you know, use, not own, right? Possession, that's not the most important thing. It's, you know, what can you use, share, and stuff. There's a lot of great stuff out there. Don't try and be everything to everybody. Remix what's already out there. Google Maps does a great job. Yahoo Maps, another great job. Don't come up with your own mapping engine. Use what's already out there and focus on what makes you special and makes you different. You don't have to reinvent everything. And then open systems, not closed ones, right? The more open you are, the more you can get that positive feedback loop. The more you syndicate out your content and your data, the more likely you're going to have all those links back to your site so that you get higher in sort of the Google page ranks. The more things that people can do with your system, the more they give you free advertising, they enhance the value of your system, and once they're plugged into your system, they're more likely to stay with you, and that sort of increases that stickiness of each person.
Great. Well, let's take any other questions from the floor, any last-minute thoughts or things you want to hear about on the topics, or even maybe something that we didn't mention that you'd like to bring up. So we're going to start with a question over here.
I'm kind of interested in, there's another buzzword that's on people's minds, which is the semantic web. How does the semantic web interact with or resolve the future and issues of Web 2.0?
To be honest, I'm not really sure. I think that is one of those words that is just so overloaded, and everybody talks about the semantic web as a better way of classifying and, you know, tracking everything. Web 2.0, I mean, it tries to take advantage of what everybody's impressions, everybody's impressions about the web and each individual page, I mean, tagging and collaboration. The semantic web, a different way of looking at it, I think it's still just too broad of a term, and I don't know that anyone really knows what it is yet.
Anyone else want to? I feel like such a failure. Is anybody else going to take that one? Anyone know, familiar with the semantic web and what that's all about?
I don't think it's gotten out of the laboratories to a point where people can really use it, talk about it, point to it, you know, leverage it.
You're starting to see tool development and ontologies and semantic relationships and some going to the issue of Wikipedia, for example, where you have relationships between, you know, all of those links online are undefined links, they're one-way links. There are serious problems with that from an intellectual point of view. The semantic web threatens to help fix that by adding some directionality and some labeling of those relationships.
There's a group over at UVA, Eric Hatcher. I don't know how many people you know Eric Hatcher, but he works with a group over at UVA, and what they're doing is indexing. They're indexing books and searching books, and they're you know great works of English, great works of writing that have been translated by multiple people, have been commented by multiple people, and so one of the things they're doing is developing tools that allow you to index all these variations of books and see how they've all changed in different directions and see where one translator or one person's change of one little word has really changed what the meaning of it is, and then the next person who analyzes the book and makes other changes on it, it goes in multiple directions. So, you know, better tools for looking at all the content and understanding what it all is and, you know, how it's changing, what I mean by one buzzword versus what another person means by another buzzword. They're coming, but they're definitely still very much a laboratory or research exercise.
And we have another question here from Ted.
Web 2.0 is really hot right now. There's no doubt about that. But I guess probably the main question everybody here wants to know is there any way possible I can leverage my business to take advantage of this? Because it seems to me like Web 2.0 is essentially handing over your product or service, and you've got this whole amplified power of the internet acting on it. Once you hand it over, do you have any control over it? Can you leverage it to make more money?
I think as long as you're sort of a thought leader, right? Whatever your product is, there's a lot of information that you know about that product that your customers do not know about it. So you have to start really getting active out there. You gotta, you know, you gotta start blogging about your product, and you gotta do it in a way that people don't feel like it's just marketing, you know, pablum being handed to them. You know, you need to be out there and searching around. And when people say, oh, I did X, Y, and Z and it was terrible, right? You need to be right there on the comments underneath it and saying, okay, you know, this is what you could have done, or, you know, and by the way, I'm blah, blah, blah from this organization. We make it, and, you know, here's my email address. You got to kind of put yourself out there and be willing to take some risks. I think that's kind of to his, it's an attitude, sort of, right? It's an approach to openness. And you got to expect that you're going to have a little bit of, you know, waffling happening to you, you know, because you are pushing out a lot more. But, you know, the amplification effect that the internet is going to provide by you distributing more of your information, whatever makes you special and making it easier for lots of people to take advantage of, is where the Web 2.0 is going to help. So, you know, all of you should be on Wikipedia. You know, Jason Hall put us on Wikipedia a couple weeks ago. You look for open source connections, and there we are. It's a little one-liner. I mean, you should just put yourself out there, and that increases the value, you know, the number of hits to your site, and the content that you produce becomes more valuable the more people who see it and can take it and do what they want with it.
I think, too, regardless of what type of company you have, you're going to see a major paradigm shift in the next few years of how every business operates. And that is, today, how many companies have search engine optimizers on staff? How many people have people who are corporate bloggers on staff? How many companies actually do a podcast? There are a lot of companies out there that still are not getting on board with it because they don't have the expertise. And unless you're a technology company, and most of us in here are probably all technology companies or associated with technology in some way, if you are a technology company and you're putting out technology products and services, you're probably a little bit more on the cusp of this. But I'll tell you, I have a lot of clients who are not. And so there's kind of a chasm, to use a Jeffrey Moore term, crossing that chasm. But there's a chasm between everyday types of businesses, local businesses especially, and then technology businesses. I think technology businesses are a little bit more on top of all this new technology and Web 2.0. But the question is, how do you then integrate it with your business? Well, you have to think about ways that things in the Web 2.0 sphere can help you. Blogs, podcasts, can they help your individual company? If you're a realtor in Charlottesville, Virginia, how do you use the Web 2.0 to help you? And I think that there's a lot of different ways you can do that, but what you're going to see is they're going to be staff members, or you're going to outsource this going forward, because it's going to become a huge issue for every company going forward. How do I get my business onto the web, regardless of if you're a local company, a technology company, or a brick-and-mortar retail company? It does not matter, because as I was saying, even just for brick-and-mortar retail, people search on the web first. So how do you control your presence, your brand, and all of those things with Web 2.0, and monitor things that can go on like waffles or worst president ever, but at the same time also promote your brand? There's also something I'll throw out there, too. If you are interested in putting out a new product or service, there's a really cool blogging service I found called Buzz Agent. I don't know if you've ever heard of that. But it's really more probably geared more towards consumer goods. But they actually, you send your product out to these people who are going to blog about it. They're going to test it out, and they're going to be honest about it, and then they're going to blog about it. And so that's kind of one of the new ways of marketing in this new world of Web 2.0, and I think that that's what companies are going to start moving to in the future.
The line I recently saw is we're moving from a read-only society to a read-write society, and so our consumers are going to have to be able to give us direct input back. It may be painful. We're going to get some negative publicity. We're going to get the "we weren't happy with this," but that just gives us as a company an opportunity to fix that problem. So there's this big fear that we're going to get negative publicity and that, you know, we're going to be living out there in the limelight, but it also gives us an opportunity to deal with any of the mistakes that we make and to fix them. You're rolling out a new product and you're soliciting ideas, and you know, maybe something doesn't fly very well, like MySpace's change where they started blasting out everybody's personal information. Well, they have a blog and people are writing, you know, very upset about it. The company president was able to respond to them, and that is a very personal communication that Web 2.0 helps facilitate. So look at how you can get your customers and the people who, you know, are going to be taking advantage of your services, how can you get them involved in your product or your service? How do you make them part of your company? That's the advantage that you're going to get. So it's no longer we put things out there and the world just, you know, has to take advantage of it as it will. It's now more of a two-way street.
And with that, please join me in thanking Eric and Andy and Janet for guiding us in the conversation today. A small gesture and token. You'll hear me talk a lot about the conversation and conversation space. And the conversation is what happens when you, the people in this room, put all our voices together in concert to be the focal point for the technology sector. So please continue to join us in the conversation. This conversation is also available online. We have the blog started where some comments around this theme have already been posted, so I encourage you to visit blog.vptc.org. And thank you very much for spending the afternoon with us. Enjoy.
Thank you very much.
VPTC Tech Trends program made possible by support from Inverion of Charlottesville, providing both buyers and sellers of Charlottesville real estate with the strongest possible representation. On the web at www.charlottesville-fine-homes.com.